you know, if you have this culture that teaches you that you cannot say no to people, like to anyone, including people who love you, right? Like your mom or, you know, your grandparents and things like that. Like, how terrified are you going to be to say no to people who you don't know at all, right?
When it comes to saving face, a lot of us Asians are far less likely to seek help or talk to others. Where does this come from and what are the consequences? Hello and welcome to Shoes Off, stories about Asian Australian culture. I'm Jay Uy. Saving face is something a lot of us Asians are very familiar with, even if we don't quite know how to put it in words. From fighting over the bill to politely deflecting compliments, it shows up far more often than we think. But what else does face hide and cover over? To find out, I'm going to let someone else take the hot seat. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, my name is Shona. I'm a freelance writer and I focus on topics relating to the minority experience and human rights.
So you've talked to a lot of people about saving face and what that looks like in their lives. What interested you in this topic?
A couple of months ago, I was sitting in a cafe and I started thinking about this concept of saving face and whether it was really a thing. So I posted an interview call out and overnight I had received over 50 respondents. It was pretty crazy. And I was reading through some of the respondents and I got about 30 interviews done. And I just kept thinking, this is so relatable. It just went to show how deep-seated saving face really is in the Asian culture.
Yeah, wow. That's really cool. So can you explain to me, what is this concept of face? What does it mean?
Saving face is the process of trying to avoid humiliation or shame. It's about maintaining yours or your family's reputation. I read this interesting article from Professor Harry Minnis from Monash University, and he used this example to describe what saving face was. He was talking about how in an Anglo-Australian family, if one of the members of the family has problems or is behaving badly, then the responsibility of that behavior tends to be regarded as kind of just the person who's actually engaged in the behavior. But in an Asian Australian family, if one person is doing the wrong thing, then it implicates the whole family. And I guess that comparison really shows what saving face is.
Yeah, right. It's that age-old difference between a collective versus individual society, I guess. So, well, since you've done all the digging here, why don't I let you take it from here?
Sure thing. Are you sure?
Totally sure. You got this.
My first memorable encounter with saving face was in high school. I told my mom that I had been talking to my church pastors about the impact of their divorce on me as a child, but mom couldn't really understand why I would voluntarily tell people about that sort of thing. When I tried to explain that it helps me and that it's free of judgment, she threw out these statements that, in hindsight, I guess you could summarize it as an attempt to save face. Statements like, it's embarrassing, and if people knew your parents were divorced, they'll look at you differently. We always joke about how everyone knows everyone in the Korean community, but there's some truth to it. Word spreads so fast. One interviewee told me their parents' status in the Korean-Australian community was a real deterrent in their ability to signal for help. If their parents knew each other, then anything they shared would be open. They said the inability to talk about it actually had created long-term consequences in their adult relationships. They struggled to open up and struggled to trust and be vulnerable as an adult. When I asked people what saving face meant to them, here's how they described it.
It's almost like toxic masculinity in a way, but sort of applied to everyone, like including children, babies, toddlers. We can't ask for help and we can't show that we're struggling. And, you know, like you can't sort of have any emotions or any expressions that are not clean, you know, if they're complicated or they're messy or they cause problems for anyone else or inconvenience anyone else, like, then it is morally incorrect to be doing those things, basically.
It means putting on a face where you know something has happened, but you don't talk about it. Like, you just pretend you're fine.
You know, specifically being an Asian woman too, just being perceived as the one who needs to carry the weight. And you need to be the strong woman, but you can't be vulnerable, you know? You've got to keep the family together and you've got to keep moving on. And there's no time to have anxiety. There's no time to have depression. You've just got to keep fighting.
It might sound like everything about saving face is negative, but it's not all bad. In some respects, saving face can get you out of some pretty sticky social situations. In Korean, it's called 표정관리.
A direct translation would be to manage your facial expressions.
It's about when and where you choose to show how you're feeling. For example, if someone you really dislike starts talking and you make this face instantly, your friend might point out to you, hey, get rid of that face. That itself is a form of 표정관리. There's an element of 눈치 too, and that's the art of intuitively knowing what others are thinking and anticipating what they might need or feel. In some contexts, 눈치 saves you from saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, and without it, you'd commit a lot of social mishaps. There's even a book about it written by Eun-hee Hong called The Power of 눈치, The Korean Secret to Happiness and Success. So saving face is not all bad. But the interesting thing is when that value of saving face collides with a Western context. I remember going over to my friend's house in primary school, and her parents were divorced, but her dad would still come over and have a beer with her stepdad. I could never imagine that happening in my family. It seems to clash because saving face is so ingrained across many Asian cultures, but in a Western context, it's so normal to prioritize ourselves and voice our emotions.
Okay, certainly in the East Asian context, you have the strong pull of Confucianism. You know, this is China, Korea, Japan. And in the Confucian system, which is very hierarchical, the family actually functions as a kind of microcosm for the nation.
That's Dr. Jane Park, a Korean-Australian scholar and a senior lecturer in cultural studies at the University of Sydney.
Jane says the differences in how we relate to ourselves and others can be traced back to the influence of Confucianism.
It's like in Korean, there is no word for I. Like, you know, even grammatically. Mm. Mm. 우리 엄마, 우리 아빠, right? So there's this, just even in the language, you see that reflected.
It's interesting because in everyday Korean speech, it's common to say 우리, meaning us or we or our, like 우리 남편 or 우리 집.
Our husband or our house.
It's the first person plural which replaces the use of the singular. And it's interesting how phrases like this actually influence the way we process our emotions internally.
And, you know, again, in Korea, you probably know this already, but like, I mean, we still don't really call each other by name much. It's always like where you are in the social hierarchy. So for a woman, even now, it's like 지연이 엄마, right? Or 사모님. It reflects your position. Not to say this is good or bad. It's just the model. I think that because that structure, it's so family focused and it's so group focused and it's about these hierarchies. I think that that will lend itself sometimes to people being reticent about expressing their emotions through language anyway, because that's a very Western thing.
So you have these people coming from an Eastern culture where filial piety...
That's where respect is owed to one's parents and ancestors.
And a collectivist mentality is huge. And they're living in a Western context where there are open conversations around mental health and relationships. And this can be quite confronting and tricky to navigate. That was the case in Laura's experience.
I was definitely in primary school. So at the time, my mum, she taught at my primary school, so everyone knew her, that kind of thing. But at that time, she was quite sick. So she stayed at home a lot and she couldn't deal with her work commitment. I remember teachers coming up to me and asking me, like, is your mum okay? Like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, she's fine.
Laura grew up in Western Australia with her mum, dad and older sister. But parts of their heritage, like saving face, had remained a strong family value. For Laura, saving face was a learned behavior. At first, it was just about not wanting to lose a game of cards.
And that's because losing a game is like a sign of weakness.
But as life became more complicated, saving face was taken to a whole new level.
I didn't understand what was going on. Mm. And like, this is the time before, like, you know, all this mental health stuff. And especially within Asian communities, like, we have no idea what's going on. Yeah, and the thing is, like, I don't think it ever crossed my mind that it was a mental illness. I think it was always, like, mum's being lazy. Because when I think about it now, I'm like, okay, so mum probably had depression for a really long time and it went undiagnosed. So it became an insidious part of her personality I kind of identified with.
Mental health is taboo across many Asian cultures, preventing a lot of people from seeking help. Take South Korea as an example. It's got the highest rate of suicide amongst any OECD nation.
This is a group of 36 countries that contribute the majority of the world's trade and investment.
And mental health is almost non-existent in the public conversation. Dr. Kim Hyung-soo, a psychologist and professor at Chosun University, says talking openly about emotional problems is still taboo in Korea. In a culture where saving face demands you to prioritize reputation and family name above your own needs, it's easier just to say that everything's okay.
Like, I don't remember anyone saying that I shouldn't say anything, but I remember kind of having that anxiety when I'm having that conversation with the teacher about, yeah, like, you know, when you're like, you're clearly lying, you're like, yeah, it's fine, it's fine.
I'm sure what was running through your mind would have been like, did I reveal too much? Like, did I say something wrong? Like, that's so real.
I actually think it was like delusion. Like, okay, in the sense of like, so you're a kid.
Yeah.
So you only really know what your parents tell you. You haven't like developed your sense of self or like more self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So by having them ask me, it was almost like they were poking at my bubble. So then suddenly I was like, is there something wrong? Like cracks starting to appear.
Things took a turn for the worst in high school when Laura's sister attempted suicide. It was lunchtime at school when Laura's friend spotted her sister in an ambulance. After hearing the news, she did something strange. She went straight back to class as if nothing had happened.
And that was really strange because I remember feeling like, oh, like everything's fine, you know, like trying to maintain that facade. Whereas like someone else would have just like had like a meltdown.
Yeah, and being like, sorry, like, I gotta leave.
Like a Western person would have been like,
Yeah.
But yeah, not an Asian person, right? And then, so as part of the school thing, I think they offered me counselling. I think I only must have gone there 2 or 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
But I realised now that I was just saving face.
The incident with Laura's sister changed the family forever. It was the tipping point that forced the family to address the taboo topic of mental health and start seeking professional help, but only as a last resort. In 2018, Relationships Australia,
that's a national counselling and dispute resolution service,
said only 19% of its website visitors identified as immigrants.
But let's remember that just under half of the entire population was born overseas or has at least one parent born overseas.
If you really had sort of an inside knowledge of the things, like there would be more reports, there would be more referrals, there would be more people looking for services, like the demand is definitely there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a huge lack of community education around domestic violence, around sexual abuse, around child discipline.
That's Michelle Lin, a counsellor based in Caringbah, New South Wales. Michelle is also a Chinese Australian, but during her university degree and throughout much of her working life, she noticed that the people seeking counselling and therapy aren't usually Asian.
I guess the biggest thing that I'm curious about is, from your experience, I guess, in the role day to day, are you dealing with a lot of people from Asian communities?
No, and I think we definitely should be. I definitely think we're falling through the gaps. And I don't think that's intentional, but we have such a westernized system around healthcare, around mental health, around childcare or domestic violence. Social work and counseling and psychology is like 90% white. We're definitely falling through gaps. There is definitely need.
Michelle says that one of the biggest gaps in the mental health and domestic violence system is the lack of diversity and how westernized the industry is. For a culture where saving face is widespread, additional language and cultural barriers only make it harder to access help.
Having counsellors that speak a secondary language is really hard. My background is Chinese Australian, and for me, my Chinese is okay. It's not great, but I wouldn't feel too confident counselling in it, and it's really hard to find people who are confident, who are both trained counsellors and also really fluent. You kind of get either or.
She also noticed that Asian families are more responsive to practical programs about parenting and communication rather than reflective programs.
So there are programs around parenting and communication that are either more practical based, like this is what you should do, this is what you should not do.
Mm.
And then there are programs that are more reflective of like, this is what the impact of this type of behavior is. This is the origin or source of your behavior. And I think that level of reflection is not very Asian or Chinese communities. Asian communities don't really like that. They think that's not necessary. They're like, my parenting is fine. I just need practical tips if you want to give me any. But don't talk to me about therapy. Don't talk to me about how to discipline my children.
Talking to a stranger, even if they're a professional, about some of your traumas and scars is difficult for anyone. But when you add saving face into the mix, the idea of talking openly about your emotions and feelings is like asking someone to unlearn everything they've been taught. In Laura's experience, saving face involved manufacturing a facade that everything was all right. But in this next story, we see how saving face creates a barrier between ethnicities, friends, and even loved ones.
Trigger warning, this next story from Rachel, a Chinese Australian living in Melbourne, contains references to sexual harassment and abuse.
These two guys grabbed me and like started comparing me to a geisha and asking me if I wanted like a marriage license to be able to stay in the country. And I was like, they were like taking turns to like grab me or to like slur my ethnicity, basically.
As one of the men held her hands in place, she felt her knuckles cracking beneath his firm grip. It's a terrifying and humiliating experience for anyone to be in. But there was one thought running through Rachel's head. If someone is this willing to do these things already, what else are they capable of? And if I say no, what else could he do? As an illustrator, Rachel's hands are literally her life source. She was afraid that any resistance would lead to larger consequences, and that thought immobilized her.
Like, you want to sort of get away with, like, least harm as possible, and like, because people are like, you know, why didn't you run away? Like, okay, these people can run faster than me. I'm very short. Yeah. I'm small, right? I'm not a fast runner. Yeah. Like, why didn't you say no? Like, they're already doing things to me.
Rachel bravely went to the police station to tell them what had happened. They asked her a series of questions to unpack the event, but one particular question was incredibly difficult to answer.
When I tell the police about these things later, they asked me, what were you wearing? Which was long sleeves, long pants, right? You know, then they asked me, did you say no? And I was like, that is a very loaded question.
Did you say no? It seems like a fair and simple question to be asking, but for Rachel and plenty of other Asian women like her, their understanding of saving face and cultural values means saying no is not as easy as it sounds.
You know, if you have this culture that teaches you that you cannot say no to people, like to anyone, including people who love you, right? Like your mom or, you know, your grandparents and things like that. Like, how terrified are you going to be to say no to people who you don't know at all, right? And so it makes it so hard to get justice as well, because, you know, like if someone asks you, did you say no? What are you supposed to say?
According to a national survey by ANROSE, an alarming amount of people from non-English speaking backgrounds are more likely to attribute responsibility for violence to the victim. This is also one of the reasons why Rachel still hasn't spoken to her mom about the experiences that day.
You know, have you told your mom? Like, this is a thing that white people say to me so much. Like, why haven't you told your mom about it? I didn't realize that this was like a white person thing to say at first. The first few times I heard it, I was like, oh, these people just have very open relationships with their moms, like I've seen on TV. That must be nice. But over time, like, I basically only ever hear that from white people, and they almost like shame me for not doing that. Like, oh, I can't imagine not being able to talk to my mom about this. And, you know, like, I just don't understand why you haven't told her yet. But if any person of color who has ever talked to me about it, they're like, yep, I understand completely.
Yeah.
I instantly get it. And I'm like, oh.
Data from the ABS reveals that 1 in 6 Australian women,
that's about 1.5 million people,
have experienced physical and or sexual abuse before the age of 15. Domestic violence is pervasive across all cultures, but for many women within Australia's cold communities,
that's culturally and linguistically diverse communities,
saving face can make it difficult to speak up and ask for help until the trauma or illness is too big to ignore. In Laura's case, things did get too big to ignore. Counseling and therapy helped Laura's sister work through her mental illness, and her mum opted for medical treatment. It's been a couple of years now, but Laura says her mum and sister are like completely different people. Witnessing the improvement of her family's mental health has given Laura the confidence to approach her own mental health issues. When I first spoke to Laura, her and her husband were expecting their first child. She was worried that she'd also experience a case of postnatal depression, But Laura knew that she wanted to do things differently.
So when I think about my own family, I think about how I really want to be open with my son about my depression.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm worried that this is something that's going to be carried genetically, or he's going to witness me being depressed like I witnessed my mom. Mm-hmm. But I never understood what was happening, and I think that's really scary. I want to focus a lot on emotional development with my kids and being really open about mental health and like making mistakes and things like that, like completely the opposite to how my dad operates.
How they did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd be happy to know that Laura has given birth to a healthy baby boy. She wrote me this lovely email after the interview saying, "Thanks for sharing my story. I feel heard and vulnerable and more at peace. It's healing being able to put this out into the world. And P.S., I didn't get postnatal depression. Fingers crossed it stays that way. Also, my sister who tried to commit suicide is back from traveling the world for 7 years. And it's amazing. The wounds of our childhood are healing and things are finally coming together." Thanks, Laura. She really has broken the cycle of silence. In a culture where saving face is ingrained in the way we approach divorce, mental health, sexual abuse, and other life situations, it can make us feel alone and helpless. But out of all the interviews I conducted, not one person said they regretted telling someone about their experiences. I'd encourage you to take one step towards healing and restoration by talking to a friend, a loved one, or finding professional help.
We'll have a list of resources in the show notes.
Yes, saving face is important, but choosing to speak out can bring about a lot of healing and a lot of freedom. This episode of Shoes Off was written and produced by me, Shona Yang.
With editing and mixing by me, Jay Uy.
And special thanks to all of the guests in this episode, Jane, Laura, Michelle, Rachel, and everyone else who hasn't been mentioned here but has helped me put together this story.
And special thanks to you, Shona, for putting this story together. What other resources will be available in the show notes?
Well, if you need to speak to a professional or if this story raises anything for you, we'll have links and numbers for anyone you can contact. Relationships Australia, Beyond Blue, and some more professional organisations. You can read more about Saving Face in an article that I've written for the SBS, which will also be in the show notes at shoesoff.net.
Amazing. So if you liked Shoes Off, please subscribe. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow the show on Facebook and Instagram at shoesoffau. Shona, where can people find you?
Well, you can read a bunch of articles that I've written at shonasays.com, and you can follow me at shonasays. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you have a friend that might relate to what you've heard today, please feel free to share this episode with them and encourage them.
Shona, thanks for leading the charge today.
No, thank you. You're welcome.
And thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.
Bye.
Bye. So what did you struggle about when you came to write this episode then?
Honestly, it was that I can think of so many awesome interviews that I've done, so many stories that I wanted to share, and narrowing that down to two or three was incredibly hard.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do justice for everyone. Like I can think of, yeah, a ton of people that have incredible stories and incredible journeys that I think are worth sharing. So I think that was a tough part.
Yeah. And that was me going, hey, we need to keep it to around three people.
Cut it down. Which is good, because then you'd be listening to me for like an hour. And yep. No one wants to do that.
I'm sure you all want to hear more of Shona.
Oh.
Are you going to come back for another episode?
Oh, we'll see if you'll have me.
I'd love to have you.
You've committed now, so
yes,
it's done.
It's on tape.
Proof, 21st of March.
Yep.